Okay, so hi to everyone listening. I'm your host, Frances Underhill, for the next hour. And I'm joined today by my first ever guest on the first ever 8 Tracks for 8 Ball, Lele Saveri. Hi, Lele.
You pronounce it really good.
Thank you. Thanks so much. So I think for people who are part of, or like know of 8 Ball community, you need no introduction. For those who might not know you, you're a photographer, curator, community organizer, and now you're EMT, which is emergency medical technician. Is that right?
Correct, yes.
But the reason I thought that you'd make sense to kick off this show on 8 Ball Radio is because you were the one of the founders and the de facto kind of leader for a while of 8 Ball community, of which 8 Ball Radio is a part. And that's how we first met back in, I think, 2017, something like that. I find it kind of hard to explain what the community or the collective is. Could you give just like a little brief rundown?
I think that was always the hardest point, the explanation of what the community is about. But I'm going to try and make it simple. It's shaped a lot throughout the years. But roughly, the idea is it's a place that's open to people for production of independent media
in the form of radio or TV publishing. That's kind of the very general idea. Then there's within that a lot of concept of building community, building informations from everyone's knowledge. So people are both like teaching and learning within the same sphere community.
Okay, so Lele, I asked you for 8 Tracks for 8 Ball Radio to put together a list of songs that have been pivotal or meaningful throughout your life.
Yes.
A kind of like a soundtrack to your life, perhaps.
Yeah, it was a difficult task. Mm. I made a selection of songs that I felt like at some point in my life were kind of pivotal, like that, like some importance in redirecting where I was going. In the music was really a way for me to take path and move through life. And so I just selected songs that I think helped me with that.
You said it was difficult. Were some of them just kind of like immediate things? You're like, obviously this one.
More than the songs, some of the artists were immediate. And I don't want to bring any spoilers, but there were some artists that like just at one point came into my life and they completely like shake everything that was there and directed me somewhere. So I just right away thought of those. Songs were harder in within those context. Some other songs I just had to think deeply. The ones that I decided, again, they're more the ones that like kind of helped me take turns.
Mm. Okay, well, let's kick it off with your first track. What have you chosen and why?
So the first track, I have to like read it because now I don't remember even what's the actual. Well, it's a first song that is called La Guerra di Piero, di Fabrizio De André. And the reasons why I chose that song is that it's like a 60s, I want to say. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think it's a 60s song by these like kind of political singer-songwriter. And it's a song that it's the first song that we're playing with a, here they have a different name for it, and I never really understood the American name for it, but in Italian we call it the flute, that little thing that you play like in school. I don't remember what's name.
A recorder?
Yeah, a recorder. Mm. Why is it a recorder? It's not recording shit. You're just literally blowing like a flute.
Fact.
We call it the flute.
But the flute goes to the side. What do you call that?
But that you still, it's a, in Italy we say a side flute.
Love it. Literal.
So, yeah. But anyway, it's a song that we were playing on our recorder in maybe last year of elementary school, first year of middle school, so 10, 11 years old. And it's, I had this teacher that was playing it along with the guitar and would go with the flute. And it's a song about, it's a weird song to having us play as 10 years old, because it's a song about, it's the story of a soldier who's heading back towards the end of the war, or at the end of the war, going back to his own country or town, and he's walking on these on a deserted road, and he encounters another soldier with a different uniform, and he's a moment he chooses to humanize this person and see it as a human being, because that one-on-one, and decided not to shoot it, but that person chooses not to do that to him, so he gets shot and die. So it's a very dramatic song. But I just felt like at that time, it was the first song in my family. There was a lot of music, but the music they were playing was very non-political. My family is not very political, and most of the songs they were listening to was mostly like Beatles style of songs. Those kind of like apolitical, someone might say that some of the Beatles were political, but you know, the pop, that's the music that my parents would listen to. So when I heard this song, it was kind of the first time that I clicked with like the content of the song. And around that time, like last year of elementary school, my granddad was incarcerated for 2 years in a concentration camp in Germany, and he would come to my elementary school, and he wrote a diary during that time. So he would come and read part of his diary. So I think that right around that time, I must have been like particularly tuned into like the Second World War and what that meant. So this song was the first time that I clicked on a different level with music, and it kind of made me like go on a spiral. So that's why I chose this song.
Sepolto in un campo di grano, non è la rosa, non è il tulipano che ti fan veglia dall'ombra dei fossi, ma sono mille papaveri rossi. Lungo le sponde del mio torrente voglio che scendano i luci argentati, non più i cadaveri dei soldati portati in braccio dalla corrente. Così dicevi ed era d'inverno, e come gli altri verso l'inferno, te ne vai triste come chi deve, il vento ti sputa in faccia la neve. Fermati Piero, fermati adesso, lascia che il vento ti passi un po' addosso, dei morti in battaglia ti porti la voce, chi diede la vita ebbe in cambio una croce. Ma tu non lo udisti e il tempo passava, con le stagioni a passo di Giava, ed arrivasti a passare la frontiera in un bel giorno di primavera. E mentre marciavi con l'anima in spalle, vedesti un uomo in fondo alla valle, che aveva il tuo stesso identico umore, ma la divisa di un altro colore. Sparagli Piero, sparagli ora, e dopo un colpo sparagli ancora, fino a che tu non lo vedrai esangue, cadere in terra a coprire il suo sangue. E se gli sparo in fronte o nel cuore, soltanto il tempo avrà per morire, ma il tempo a me resterà per vedere gli occhi di un uomo che muore. E mentre gli usi questa premura, quello si volta, ti vede a paura, ed imbracciata l'artiglieria, non ti ricambia la cortesia. Cadesti a terra senza un lamento, e ti accorgesti in un solo momento che il tempo non ti sarebbe bastato a chieder perdono per ogni peccato. Cadesti a terra senza un lamento, e ti accorgesti in un solo momento che la tua vita finiva quel giorno e non ci sarebbe stato ritorno. Ninetta mia, crepare di maggio, ci vuole tanto, troppo coraggio. Ninetta bella, dritto all'inferno, avrei preferito andarci in inverno. E mentre mentre il grano ti stava a sentire, dentro alle mani stringevi il fucile, dentro alla bocca stringevi parole, troppo gelate per sciogliersi al sole. Dormi sepolto in un campo di grano, non è la rosa, non è il tulipano che ti fan veglia dall'ombra dei fossi, ma sono mille papaveri rossi.
I want to kind of hear a bit about your childhood and what it was like growing up in Rome, like set the scene a bit.
My parents grew up one block or one door away from each other. So I grew up in the same street, the same area, with all four of my grandparents. So the first 6 years of my life were there. And then I think that my parents were like, had enough of being, this is on a road called Viale Marconi in Rome, that's really close to Viale Trastevere. It's like a very pretty central area of Rome. And my parents, having grown up there their whole life, they were tired of it. So they kind of chose to go to the closest further part south of Rome, in an area called Mostacciano, which is right next to an area that everyone knows, a lot of people know it, called Eur. That was an area that Mussolini built. It's a very strange area because it's very wide open with these fake classical buildings that were made of marble, but they were made during the Mussolini era. And there was a lot of green, so my parents wanted the green. Like, up to 6 years old, I was playing, like, football between cars, pretty much. And suddenly, we were in a place with, like, greens and shit. So that's where I grew the rest of my time from 6 years on. It was a strange place to grow up because you didn't really leave the area much. So as a teenager, you were just stuck, kind of. We had a scooter from the age of 13. I was riding a scooter, but you still never really went away from the area. You just stayed in a neighborhood and we would hang out. For Americans, it's difficult to comprehend, but Italy, you go to school Monday through Saturday and you finish school at 1 o'clock, lunchtime. So you do lunch at home. So for me, from the age of 10 years old on, from middle school to all of high school, I was home for lunchtime. So I would go home, cook for myself, do whatever homework I would try and do. And then by 4 o'clock, I would already be hanging out with people on the scooter. You just choose an area, it's called Comitiva, and you just hang out there.
Sounds fun.
It was fun, but also boring. You know,
right.
It's like
thing same that thing
you,
every
you just see the same people, mm-hmm. same things, nothing really happened. And maybe as we talk more about the music later, I can explain better, like, the subdivisions of Italian, like, youth.
Okay, well, maybe we should get into your next song then. Because okay. I feel like it's a little bit of departure.
Yeah, my next song is very different from this song. And I, again, as I said in the introduction, the idea is that I wanted to pick songs that were pivotal in changes. So the way that this song, this first song that turned me from just listening to songs about nothing to suddenly having some lyrics that make some sense to me. Then the first song that I felt like was mine, as in nobody else I knew these songs, was Wu-Tang. So in 93, Enter the Wu-Tang came out. And when that happened, I'd met a friend. I was 13 years old and I met a friend, like, he was the son of a colleague of my dad, and he was 16, so he was 3 years older than me, much older at that time. Felt like he was a man and I was a boy. And I had, like, already I started through the mainstream, I started listening to something that was somewhat connected to rap. This guy called Jovanotti was this really terrible Italian musician. Was doing some kind of a rap songs, and I remember liking it. And I remember then when I met this guy Emiliano, he was like, he dressed the way that I thought rappers dress, so I was very fascinated by him. So that summer he was playing music and I was really into it, and he gave me a Wu-Tang tape that he made. And I was like, that is like so good. And I really felt for the first time proud of being different than not just my family, but literally everybody I knew. And I recognized this other one person with baggy pants who was 1 year older than me, that is still to this day is my oldest friend, Giordano, who lives in London now. And I was like, we need to connect. I gave him a Wu-Tang tape, and he gave me like Colle del Fomento, this like Italian rap band. And we were like, do you know what I mean? I felt like this strong bond with like one person, and the whole neighborhood they thought we were freaks. That thing spiraled into me becoming who I am, because from that I realized I was really embracing the concept of not being mainstream. And really, this is when I stepped into that. So I chose one song from that album because that album was the album that really was fundamental for me.
Tiger style.
Tiger style. Yo. Wu-Tang Clan ain't nothing to fuck with. Wu-Tang Clan ain't nothing to fuck with. Wu-Tang Clan ain't nothing to fuck with. There's no place to hide as I step inside the room. Dr. Doom, prepare for the boom. Bam! Oh man! Ah! Slam! Damn! That scream like Tarzan! I'll be tossing and forcing, my style is awesome. I'm causing more family food than Richard Dawson. And the survey said, you're dead. Baby flying guillotine chops off your fucking head. Mister, who is that?
Hey yo!
The Wu is back! Making niggas go bobo! Like on Super Chat, me fear no one. Oh no, here come the Wu-Tang Shogun. Killer to the eardrum.
Put the needle to the groove, I get screwed and I'm forced to fuck it up. My style varies like a pickup truck. Cross the clear blue yonder. See, the China Sea, I slam tracks like quarterback sacks from LT. Now I try and test the rebel lioness. Blessed since the birth, I earth slam your best. Cause I bake the cake, then take the cake and eat it too with my crew while we head state to state.
And if you want beef, then bring the ruckus. Wu-Tang Clan ain't nothing to fuck with. From the motherfucking slum that busted. Wu-Tang Clan ain't nothing to fuck with.
Niggas in Sleepy Hollow. In fact, I'm a hard act to follow. I dealt for Dolo. Bogart coming on through. Niggas is like, oh my god, not you. Yes, I come to get a slice of the punk in the pot. Rather do than die. Check my flavor. Coming from the visor with the show for the razor. Who make me reminisce true like deja? Who? I'm rubber. Niggas, it's like glue. Whatever you say, rubs off me. Sticks to you.
This the ODB kid, new radio version for you, called Shame on the New.
So everybody, I jump on it.
Shame on the nigga who tried to run game on a nigga, who's butt wild with the trigger.
Shame on the nigga who tried to run game on a nigga,
who's butts our fuck ass up.
Yo, hut one, hut two, hut three, hut.
Old dirty bastard, live and uncut. Styles unbreakable, shatterproof. To the young youth, you wanna get gun? Shoot, blah. How you like me now? Don't fuck the style. Ruthless, wow. Do you wanna get your teeth knocked the fuck out? Wanna get on it like that? Well then shout.
Your RZA, your razor, hit me with the major. The damage, my clan understand.
So did your style in terms of like how you dressed and stuff, that changed as a result of listening to like this album and being introduced to this? Did it opened up like a whole new way of being Lele?
Yes, 100%. It was difficult because at that time was not very, there weren't like stores you can go in Italy. Here it's 93, in America everyone, you could go anywhere and find everything. But in Italy there was one store called Planet that was in the middle of Rome that sold baggy pants, very expensive baggy pants, and spray paint and spray caps. But I couldn't really afford, I mean, I was 13, I didn't really have any money, so I would like use my dad's jeans. They were like very, like, this is also 90s, so people already dressed big, but my dad's pants were like huge to me, so I would just use those like baggy pants. I would wear like, I would buy bigger like sweaters or polos or whatever. Like, yeah, I would totally like go embrace the whole like hip hop thing. And I, for a few years, maybe for like, until I learned something else, but I never really abandoned rap, like hip hop as music. And through that, I got into graffiti right away, also already that same summer. I saw the two things very connected. Later on, I totally didn't see them necessarily tied to each other. But at that time, I felt like, oh, you do one, you do the other. It's the same thing. And so I started writing graffiti around the same age, 13, 14. And yeah, definitely changed my aesthetic a lot.
What was your tag?
So at that time was... it's always embarrassing to talk about this. But my very first tag, I decided it was going to be Sera, which was my initial Saveri, S. E for Emanuele, which is my actual name. Roberto Alessandro, which were my second name, like my...
Middle names.
Yeah, middle names, whatever you want to call them. And Sera means evening, so I used to write Eve or evening. And then later on I changed and went for something more embarrassing, which I don't even want to say.
It's but a safe space.
I know, but it is embarrassing. So I don't,
no, I want to
keep
it
to myself.
Yeah, but yeah, you'll add some secrets.
Yes, yes. But yeah, graffiti, not related necessarily to music, but graffiti was huge part of my life, still is. A lot of my connections, yeah, I've traveled the world through graffiti. I see the world different through graffiti. I became a photographer, I think mostly because of graffiti, because you take pictures in graffiti and you learn how to see, to experience the city differently and view the city differently. That desire of looking is what developed earlier on my desire and thirst for looking around and being a documentarian. The thing that was incredible is that I lived very close to the biggest train yard for the subway. So at 14 I already climbed in and went and painted trains. And the beautiful thing of graffiti in Rome during my time in Rome, the whole 90s, so they wouldn't get cleaned off, they wouldn't be buffed. So you would write, you would paint on a train, it would run as long as you could until somebody would go over it. So it began all of this war, because eventually the space ended. There were only so many trains they could keep, so you had to go over people, and you chose to go over your enemies, and so you build enemies. It was very fussy. It's basically, I always try to compare that time graffiti in Rome to the New York graffiti of the 70s and 80s, where you could just paint and people would see your graffiti forever. No one would clean it.
When you were graffitiing at that time, was there growing up in such like a historical place that I think people put so much importance on Rome and the way it looks, and were there places you felt were kind of off limits? It felt almost like disrespectful to...
Absolutely. Okay. Yes. A lot of Romans are, I'm saying Romans by being like people from Rome. A lot of Romans graffiti writers are like very, very aware of that. And although you try to react to that kind of classicism, that's why you do what you do, you still have the deepest respect for it.
Okay, let's listen to your next song. What we got?
Okay, my next song... I want to say my next song, it's it's Lullaby by The Cure. And I picked this song because this is the first concert that I went to see as on my own. And I grew up with a lot of 80s music. I had like an uncle who was only 10 years older than me. It was my dad, my mom's brother. And he was really into Depeche Mode, The Cure, Duran Duran. So he would always play that kind of music. So I always had it with me, and I had a girlfriend at this time. This is, was 94 when I went, 94, 95 when I went to see The Cure. She was like a goth girl and wanted to see, so I went to see The Cure. Song that I chose, it's a song that it's by a band that it's a punk band, but it, I would say now in retrospect, it's kind of like a bit of a pop punk band, but it, to me, I never heard to punk. Like, I was like I knew of the concept of punk because you see on TV, and I thought it was something away from me, and I was really into, again, graffiti hip hop. That was like old, and I thought there could be no overlaps. But then once I went to high school, so at 14, somebody play for me. It was really big at that time, this band called CCCP, and this is, there was this one album that they made at that time that was really, I mean, it was punk in a way that, again, for me at that time was very punk. For me today, it felt like, even a few years later, I was like, that's not punk. But I really think it was like, again, another pivotal thing, because it's something that showed me another world. And this song is by CCCP. The album was Fedeli alla Linea, and this song is Spara Iuri.
Spara! Spara! Spara!
Until 2 weeks ago, there was none of their songs on Spotify, but then somebody just made like all of their albums together into like a new record, and it's a new thing that they're on Spotify.
Just in the nick of time.
I know, perfect for this.
What age were you when you were listening to this then?
So this is 14. So 14, 15 when I started high school. It's when like I went from doing like just, you know, also a year at that time felt so long. And then 15, something happened that made me go in a different directions, which I saw my first mods and skinheads in person. There was like a fight happening. Actually, I was going to see my friend Giordano, I was saying earlier, who we were like both like rappers together, or like writing graffiti together and everything. And he was walking distance to my house. I was walking to him, and as I'm walking, waiting for him downstairs, I see this guy running, and he's a punk, and he has like a big cross punk, and he's chased by this mod guy with a, for what I remember, a very long pole, and he's just chasing him, and there's this big fight. And then I see further out, there's like more people fighting. And I was shocked. I had no idea who these people were, and they looked very cool and very weird and very aggressive. Very, very tight pants, which for me was crazy because I wore really baggy pants at that point. And then a week later, randomly, the mod that was chasing the punk, I met this person because he lived on in the building where my girlfriend at that time lived, the one that I went to see The Cure with. And they told me about mods. They told me about this culture, and I got really fascinated by it. But I was also embarrassed because I was really into hip hop, so I was embarrassed to see these people who were older than me. And then I was embarrassed with the graffiti rappers people. But me and my friend Giordano were always together in these, so at least I had always somebody with me. And in fact, the next song that I picked, it's a Small Faces song, this like mod band, which I think is my beginning to go towards London, because then from that I learned about Oi, punk, the movement, the mods, and so on. I also want to say almost none of these songs at that time had any lyrical meanings to me, because I didn't speak any English. So if I were to play for you something now, I don't know what that meant at that time.
Oh my, I had not thought of that aspect.
Yes, very, very fundamental. Like, to me, Wu-Tang, they would just sound great. I had no idea what it was.
So were you like singing and rapping along, but like making noise?
My own lyrics.
Right.
I mean, it's also the time of like the really MTV came to either in 92, so it was 93, and it was only broadcast at night on a regional TV, so I could only catch it at night, and they would do these night show called Yo MTV Rap, which here is during the day, but for us was like at night, at midnight. And I would record all of them and just try to understand what they're saying and trying to write down and create my own meanings.
Okay, let's listen to Small Faces.
Yes.
When did you start learning English and be like, oh wait, this is a song about getting on with my neighbors?
Yeah, only when I went to London. So not until 2000, when I moved to London, 2001, that I really could understand what it was. So I re-listened to all of these songs later and appreciated in a deeper way much later. Up to when I was 17, all my world was around my area. And then I met, when I was 17, I met this girl which strange, but at that time was a woman to me almost, who was 21. I was 17. She was a graffiti writer. Noah, she wrote. Her name was Chiara, was a skinhead. So there were very few people that did graffiti and didn't look like hip hop. And I was one of them, and she was one of them. So we clicked, but she introduced me. She lived on the opposite end of Rome, on the north side of Rome. And so even just hanging out with her was like half an hour, 45 minutes ride on my scooter through Rome, and we were in gout almost every day. And she hung out with older people, older than me at least. And it just really opened up my head. I was like, oh, wait, it's not just this one place. There's also these. And these people, they talked about other things that I didn't know. And it was very interesting for me. And with Chiarita, we started going, Chiara, this girl, that time Chiarita means little Chiara, because she was little, even though she was older than me. We started going to rave. This is like 97, 98, 99. It was like big rave scene everywhere, and in Rome especially. And there was one kind of music that was connected. We were both into like oi punk, like skinhead punk. But there was this one kind of techno music that was very hard, and people dressed like skinhead. It was called Gabber. And that's the music that then I learned with her. We walked into this other world. If you haven't realized, I was very fascinated earlier on by youth culture and just stayed within the concept of counterculture, youth culture, kind of my whole life. I think that this idea of like parallel reality to society always gave me so much hope, because it means that we're not all the fucking same and we're not just doing whatever TV and radio are telling us to do. So to me, it was the same. I just, we carried from a counterculture, walked into this other counterculture, the Gabber counterculture, for 2 years. Did a lot of drugs, went to a lot of raves.
Wore tracksuits?
Wore tracksuits, wore bomber jackets, shaved, stayed kind of the same, but also very different. And so I chose to play this one Gabber track, which I felt like, it's like maybe one of the first Gabber track I've actually ever heard, and it's by Rotted on Tarot Corpse.
Actually, I was telling a mutual friend that I was going to do this interview with you, and he was like, get ready to hear some GABA.
Out of all the things that I did in my youth, this was the one thing that I never thought would come back. GABA was very much something that only existed at that time, and it felt was so hyper-local. They even in Rome was the biggest scene, I think, beside Netherlands, of GABA, I think, in Europe. And there was nothing else. I remember when I moved to London, actually, talking of London, I would tell people about GABA, and no one knew about GABA. The only, they thought that GABA was this happy, hardcore techno, but it was not. When they would play me, what they thought was always different. But this whole culture of tracksuit, as you said, and shaved head and bomber jackets didn't really arrive even to England. It was like across from Amsterdam or Rotterdam. I don't know, it's strange because I feel like, again, going back to the concept of youth culture, I feel like every youth culture I went through, it was like a regurgitation of something already old and from other areas of the world and retaken and recontextualized in the Italian environment. Whilst GABA was the one thing that was really happening then. Even a lot of famous like GABA DJs were Italian, so there was actually, it was happening then. So it was the only time that I felt like I was going in line. It didn't last long because ultimately there's a lot of fascinating things of that culture, but GABA culture was very toxic for me. Like I was coming from like violent like background. As I said, my first encounter with skinheads and mods and punks was through violence, and graffiti was all through violence. As I was saying earlier, you had to go through somebody, go over someone, so you had beef with people, you had enemies. I had areas in Rome where I couldn't go for so long of my life. I couldn't go to some areas in the center of Rome because there'd be my enemies there. So I was really used to the violence. But GABA was another level. GABA was like every rave that I went to ended up in people throwing tables. I've seen somebody coming out with the chainsaw. I've seen people really being like really devastatingly like hurting each other. Everyone is on speed. Everyone is on like really like heavy drugs that just make everybody so tense. So after 2 years, and I realized that as I was in that world, I realized that GABA became politicized. So in those 2 years, even, I realized that people were started embracing right wings, and it just got scary. And I just got away from it. And that's kind of, I think that's all of that connected is what brought me back to like be more into being a mod and wanted to go to London, because I was like, fuck, this is the only people that I have. The only connection that I had at that time in Rome was very connected to aggression and violence, and I kind of wanted to escape that, and I wanted to learn English, and I wanted to not do a shitty job in Italy, and I felt like I need to like learn something else, and went to London at age of 20.
So a bit of escapism.
100%.
Yeah.
I was escaping. Thinking it was going to be for maybe a year. Now it's been 22 years and more that I've been away. Spent more time outside of Italy than in Italy.
Yeah. So in London was when you started photography?
Yes. In London I started photography. In London I worked in a kitchen of Pizza Hut, and I worked there for 3 years. But after a few months that I was there, I met this person, Jules, who was half Italian, half English. We got along because we could speak Italian together. And then one day, she was like, you gotta learn English. Tomorrow morning, we wake up, we only speak English. And 20 years ago, more to now, we only speak English. We're still very close friends. And she was going to Central St. Martin School of Art. And she introduced me, she took me to museum, she took me to the Tate.
She showed me photo books. Her dad was a documentary director, and he showed me books by... I remember Don McCallum, this British photojournalist. And I remember just really like changing my view. I was like, okay, this is cool. Like, documenting is cool. I wanted to, like, I thought there was a way for me to do kind of some kind of a social justice work through photography. This is, again, 2000, 2001. Newspapers still were very meaningful. People understood the news through photography a lot more than now. And I don't know. I thought it was important, and I really loved it. And right away, I got so hooked to it, and I am still very much hooked.
Is it around that time that you started being interested in kind of self-publishing and zines and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, that came before, because already in around 94, 95, the only way of seeing other writers was through zines. People photocopy colored zines in black and white and just spread them around. And so I would collect a lot of them, and sometimes with my friends we'll make zines of our own graffiti, make collages and give it to other people. The zines seemed just like a way of like spreading photographs around. I did see photography as being political. I wanted to be like a photojournalist. I really didn't want to do other things. The zine itself was just a way of like sharing work.
I remember when we were first met, I remember you telling me about your time in Hong Kong, photographing the Umbrella Movement there, which was the protests in, I guess, was it 2014?
Yeah, I went the first time in 2014, yes.
Yeah, this started as a reaction to China encroaching on the political autonomy of Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd met and worked with Joshua Wong, who I'd also just met in London, because we'd shown a film about him at the film festival I work for. And he's just such an inspired, he was this kind of student leader of these protests, and just such an incredible figure.
Well, I think he's in jail still now.
Mm-hmm. So how did you find yourself out there? And what excited you about photographing movements like that? Is that kind of where you wanted to take your photography and the world you wanted to be in?
It was very so. I think that, like, yeah, doing reportage was what I wanted to do. It was difficult work wise because then around the time when I started working as a photographer, digital started coming around, and I really couldn't switch to digital. I couldn't afford it, and I also didn't really like so much. So shooting films, it was difficult to get hires in photojournalism where the news needed to go fast. So I never really got to be like a real photojournalist. But I really enjoy it for myself to go and document protests. To these days, I don't even document it for anybody than for myself. It's kind of like, to me, it's one of the most exciting thing. It connects to my time as a 14 years old, going to the first protest. Actually, was like very related to today. My first protest in 94 was the first Intifada, was for the end of the first Intifada and the Oslo Accord. And I remember just like going to this thing, and I could not believe the kind of feeling that I felt being in a place surrounded by hundreds of people that were taking over a space in such a way that was so disruptive and so unusual. And so, like, just it gave me this other, like, it gave me this power and gave me the idea of people taking back kind of the knife handle from society for even just like one afternoon. And it just always felt like the most incredible thing to be in a protest. And I remember I did a lot of protests in Rome, and I was in Genoa in 2001 doing a famous protest for the G7, I think it was called at that time, where Carlo Giuliani died. And I remember seeing so much violence by police at that time. Then I remember in London, there was the beginning, the first war in Iraq, like the Gulf War, 2002, 2003 protests. So when I started taking pictures around that time, I started really feeling so much, I need to take pictures of these. Those pictures go nowhere and nothing really changes, but it just felt like this is the most, like the deepest experience like that I could have, and I want to document it and keep it for me.
Okay, what's your next song?
So my next song, it's a song because, so I was talking about Jules, after only a few months we were together, maybe a month only, she took me to see a concert of Desmond Dekker as a surprise, which was incredible. Desmond Dekker was like, it's a big like Jamaican artist, and in the skinhead world was like really fundamental. And at that show there were maybe like 150-200 people, it was a very small show. And then at the end, Prince Buster, who was my idol at that time, show up and played with Desmond Dekker on stage, which is to these days maybe one of the best concerts I've ever seen. And so I chose to play one of Prince Buster's, one of my favorite songs of Prince Buster, Madness.
Madness, madness, they call it madness. Madness, madness, they call it madness. It's plain. Madness, 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 they call it madness. I'm about to explain that someone is using his brain. Madness, madness, they call it madness.
So it seems to me a lot of your interests are to do with creating communities, creating collaboration and exchange kind of outside of monetary structures. And I feel like it's kind of hard to do that in places like New York.
I know.
It's so, the yeah, worst. What's your secret? How have you've managed to do it, you know, with things like the newsstand, Mug Guts, 8 Ball?
I mean, I honestly, I don't know what manage means. If manage to do it means just doing it, I think everyone can do just anything if they want to. Even if you don't have money, you can find a way. And I know that maybe I'm talking from a privileged perspective. I was lucky enough to be considered by people. I don't know, it's a strange thing to do, because I see the importance of the having to raise money in a place like New York, especially, where everything is monetary, as you said. But I also feel like whenever you do something with the intention of raising money, you can't fully be genuine about whatever it is that you're doing. And that's at least what I always felt. And so when I really started deciding that I wanted to do stuff that wasn't raising money, it was after like years of having used my passion, photography, to raise my own money and seeing how that had affected my love for photography. And I just felt like, okay, I'm compromising myself left and right just because I have to pay the bills. And I thought that perhaps if I did a job that I really loved, I would have wanted to do it forever. But I'm in a place where, like, when I wake up and I have a shoot today, I'm not happy. I'm not going to the shoot happy. And so all of those things made me realize that I needed an outlet that wasn't asking me for money. And so I just felt like, okay, what can these be? And this is kind of how Able pretty much started. The way that I did it was just sacrificing, just like not seeing my time spent in there as a value, and just seeing it as a value, as a monetary value, but a value for myself. So I never tried to monetize on that and try to find other ways of making money. And how did I take over places? I take over spaces that I knew they weren't going to be forever, that I was only allowed to pay that cheap rent because it was only for like 6 months, or I was not allowed to have the keys to the place, or I had to like compromise doing some stuff. I don't know, whatever it was always like the newsstand. I had to like, in order to pay the rent, I knew that I could only do it for like a few months, and I had to produce some content on the side for the people that were paying for it. So I realized that in order, I wanted to do, what I wanted to do was more important than trying to do it in a way that could be self-sustained, but just do it, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of, you're kind of just like rolling with the punches. It was, everything has always kind of stayed transient and permutated to what it needs to be at that time. And be that now, like 8Ball is like a proper non-profit with a paying rent in this physical space, but it's been through so many different iterations and different ways of being.
And that's why I'm saying, that's why I said at the beginning, it's not about the managing, because to some people, we didn't really manage to do a lot of the things, because staying for 8 months in a place, it doesn't mean that you're managing. To many people, it would be a failure, you know what I mean?
Just a matter of perspective.
Exactly. So and depending on what perspective, for me, 8 months was enough to at least do something or something.
Exactly. And then you being an EMT, I mean, that's like direct help and change in people's lives, but also does feel like a complete pivot. What inspired that?
It came from the feeling of a protest isn't changing the world. Able isn't changing the world. I need to stop thinking that I want to change the world. I should just realize that all I can do is change the little things that are around me. And so the 10 patients that I've had on that day, I know that they're going to be taken care of with love and compassion, and I'm just going to do it. And I realized it was a world of EMS, like emergency medical services, that it was somewhat corrupted in America, because you have to have money. It costs $1,000 to be on a ride on an ambulance, and you get paid shit. So all the EMS people they discourage. You are used by the city as some kind of a cleaning tool to get rid of who they don't want to see, the drunken in the street, the homeless in the street, the, you know, the rioters or whatever. Doing this job, because there are people that every day need the help and they don't necessarily get the kind of help that they deserve. And so as much as I can, I feel like I can do it now. I'm able and I should be doing it.
I hope you don't get jaded too.
I hope I won't get jaded too. It's been 3 years and I can see the weight of the job, but I feel like I can go for another few years at least.
Okay, what's your next song? I don't know what we're up to now. What number?
I'm my last song.
This is your last one?
Yeah.
Okay.
So my last song, I want to introduce it. So it's New Roses, which is not a... It's a band that... I had some friends in Rome that were obsessed with New Roses. But it's a band that, for some very bizarre reason, accompanied me a lot when I moved to New York. Mm. So when I was 30, I moved to New York. And I don't know. I moved in the winter. I moved at the end of January. And it was just... There was a snowstorm the first week I was here. And I was staying at Giuseppe's house. And I just... remember spending a long time indoor listening to New Roses. So for me, if I think of like my time coming here, New Roses is kind of like the band. This is one of the songs from Enemy of the Sun, is the album, A Razor Stray.
Anyway, Lele, thank you so much for sharing your eight tracks for April with me.
Thank you.
My first guest.
Thank you for being the first guest.
And actually for introducing me to a lot of music I didn't know and taking me down memory lane for some of the stuff I did know.
Cool.
But I hope you had fun.
I had great fun. Thank you.
Okay. That's it. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Done.
Done.